Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Angeline Jolly and Paula Seago? Angeline Jolly and Paula Seago are a mother and daughter duo out of Little Rock. Angeline is a singer, songwriter, guitarist, and drummer who writes for different artists and also plays in a trio with both her parents. And Paula Seago has been doing radio and TV jingles and commercials since the 1970s and is currently in four different bands. More can be found at ajolly.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a special edition of Tales from the South, our annual holiday show where Southerners bring their own true Christmas stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Little Rock native Mark Simpson was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Doug Norton, and our featured piece is this piece right over here entitled Simply Santa, which is for sale. Because it's our holiday show, we are also featuring these incredible squirrel soaps by artist April Ripper, handmade in Sherwood, Arkansas, with kakui nut oil from Hawaii. April is here tonight, right back here. She has soaps for sale after the show, and our listeners can find out more at facebook.com/squirrelsoaps. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Yeah! Tonight is our annual holiday show, where our stories are from Christmases gone by. Some many, some just a few years ago. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Sandra spots Hamilton and her sister plot to pull an all-nighter and catch the man in red. And we'll end the night with Bill Scott making his wish list and the item at the top of it. But let's start the night with Paul Bowen, A Last Christmas, and a gift in Each to Each.
One of the things that you learn pretty quickly when you admit a loved one to the nursing home is that it's hard to buy stuff for them. The rooms are small and utilitarian, even in a facility as nice as the one Mother was in. There's simply not much room to accommodate a lot of extraneous objects. These constraints make gift-giving problematic, and while I have no particular use for the holidays, or general use even come to think of it, I always felt compelled to visit Mother on Christmas morning. This is despite the fact that I'm not superstitious in the slightest, and with the certain knowledge that towards the end of her life, Mother didn't know Christmas from baseball's opening day. Indeed, there were days that she couldn't recall my name. It is for this reason I usually wore a jacket and tie when I visited her. She may not have known who I was, but when I arrived thus adorned, she suspected that I might be somebody important. She suspected. Besides, it's marketing 101. You know, when you've got a marginal product, you try to put it in a nice package. Mother loved flowers. She always kept them going around her house. And so the last couple of Christmases, I would take her a bouquet of fresh flowers. Now, she may have had an imperfect understanding about the identity of the guy wearing a tie that was visiting her, but damned if holding flowers in her hands didn't ignite some happy spark in what was left of her memory. She would inspect the bouquet with an interest and focus that she could rarely summon forth in those later days, and she would name the flowers that it contained, one by one by one, each to each. And in this way, by calling the names of her Christmas flowers, lucidity made a cameo appearance in Mother's life. Inevitably, one of the workers at the nursing home would show up with a vase. I would put the flowers in a vase and place it on the nightstand. She would gaze at them with the contented expression of a little girl with a toy. Pretty, she would say. So pretty. Since we couldn't really talk, I used to sing for her. I had an old Baptist hymnal that I stole from her mother's church. I would sing Christmas hymns to her out of that old hymnal. Again, this was not like me, as I'm not usually given to magical thinking. My United Methodist hymnal would have sufficed. But it just seemed better to sing to Mom from the book out of her people's church, which, of course, once again, I stole from the Baptists. But what she liked best was an old black spiritual that I first heard when I was a kid back in Maplevale. I don't know why, but Mother loved the old spiritual Sweet Little Jesus Boy. Maybe it was because she had boys, but she always paid special attention when I would sit by her bed and sing it. Christmas 2008 was the last one that I spent with my mother. She lapsed into a coma during Advent the following year. They say that folks in comas hear more than you know. And so one night I went back up to the nursing home when things began looking grim. I pulled up a chair and I sang the old hymns out of that ancient Baptist hymnal. And I sang Sweet Little Jesus Boy for my mother one last time. Sweet little Jesus Boy, they made you be born in a manger. Sweet little holy child, we didn't know who you was. Didn't know you came to save us, Lord, to take our sins away. Our eyes were blind, we could not see, and we didn't know who you was. Long time ago, you was born. Born in a manger, Lord, sweet little Jesus boy. This old world treats you mean, treats me mean too. But that's how things are done down here, and we didn't know who you was. You have told us how we are trying. Master, you have shown us how, even when you was dying. Just seems like we can't do right. Look how we treated you. But please, sir, forgive us, Lord. We didn't know it was you. Sweet little Jesus boy, born a long time ago. Sweet little holy child, and we didn't know who you was. Mother died on December 9 of that year. After somehow living without nourishment or water for about 7 days, if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I wouldn't have believed it. I don't think much about heaven. Surely not as much as I ought to. Some people talk of pearly gates or streets of gold, but that strikes me as foolishness. I don't know what all I believe anymore. I really don't. But I would like to think that God has better things to do than land use planning. Still, I would like to think that when I sing, Mom still hears more than I think she does. And it pleases me to think that maybe she has a garden in the heaven that the mother of four boys surely deserves. We're surrounded by the flowers that she loves. She calls them all by name, one by one by one, and each to each. Thank you.
Arthur Paul Bowen is a writer, whiskey tenor, and recovering lawyer. His writing has appeared in the Dallas Morning News, the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, the Arkansas Times, Soiree Magazine, and bourbonandboots.com. He lives in the Hillcrest area of Little Rock, where he foolishly agreed to be president of the Residents Association. Next, Sandra Spots Hamilton comes up with a Kris Kringle theory and then a plan to prove it in The Santa Hypothesis.
This was going to be my year of discovery. I had tossed and turned and kicked sister a few times on the lumpy divan we shared in the living room when Grandma and Grandpa visited from Pine Bluff and used our bed. We were only inches away from the tree, so how hard could it be to uncover the mystery of one Santa Claus, a.k.a. Saint Nick, the jolly elf, Kris Kringle, Father Christmas? My plan was simple. Any 9-year-old should be able to stay awake or at least be awakened at the sound of hooves or bells or chimney sliding activity. I would stay still as a log, pretend to be sleeping, and open only one eye once the intruder entered our house. Earlier in the week, I had done my background work. Folklore had told me that Santa usually gained entrance by means of a chimney, which we did not have. Instead, our 1904 built home did have a narrow, exposed brick column in the kitchen, which Daddy had explained once served as a vent for the wood cook stove that was used in the house long ago. I figured that possibly, somehow, Santa could squish himself and shimmy down. But where would he come into the house? There was no visible opening. He would just be stuck. I took my investigation to the living room. I looked up at the transom above the outside door. The glass in it had broken, leaving a pie-shaped opening. The glass replacement project was no doubt on Daddy's long list of home repairs. I stared at it and began to postulate. Of course, Eureka! Santa is sometimes called a spirit in storybooks, and spirits can make themselves vapor-like and float through tiny openings and then reconstitute themselves. So there was my answer. Now all I had to do was stay awake to catch him in the act of leaving presents under the tree, taking a bite out of those cookies and drinking the milk we left him. Then I would have not only confirmation that Santa did exist, but also knowledge of his MO for getting into our house. Sister and I had also heard the rumor that sometimes Santa asked parents to store presents until his Christmas Eve visit. So once our parents were at work where they belonged, we went to work. We buzzed through every nook and cranny in the old house like termites in a lumberyard. Finally, we laid flat on our bellies and lifted the bedspread to reveal the creepy space under their bed. There it was, the mother load. Not only did we uncover the cash waiting for Santa's distribution under the tree, but also gifts that had been mailed from out-of-town relatives. We gingerly slid our fingers under tape and slowly peeled back printed paper on box after box. Our eyes grew as big as the silver dollars Aunt Irma had sent in zippered coin purses. We delighted in prying open the riches of Atlanta boxes Aunt Blanche sent to find grown-up silver bangle bracelets. Since Santa never wrapped gifts he meant for our house, checking out his offerings was easy. There was the Betsy Wetsy doll sister had asked for, and a curious baby doll with freakishly long hair that I supposed was meant for me, since the Catholic nun doll I had circled in the Sears catalog was missing. To this day, I'm not sure what in my Lutheran upbringing made me want a nun doll. But I do know that the chances of Santa delivering it to our Protestant door were slimmer than Santa making a guest appearance at the local synagogue. We rummaged through the rest of the booty and then craftily replaced the paper and ribbon we had slipped off the relatives' gifts and placed everything in the exact positions where we had discovered them and slid ourselves out from under the bed, smug in our ability to crack the Santa mystery. Now we had confirmation that he did indeed ask parents to store treasures. We knew he couldn't possibly carry toys for every child in the world in that sleigh. This must be why Mama has that book from the bank that says Christmas Club on the cover. She keeps track for Santa. The time was drawing near. We'd been to Christmas Eve service, recited our parts just as Daddy had rehearsed with us. He was determined that his shy, soft-spoken little girls would develop stage voices. So every year, as soon as the parts were handed out at church, we had to memorize our parts, step into the bathroom, close the door, and recite our verses loud enough for Daddy to hear us in the living room. For several nights, we exchanged muffled shouts of, "And it came to pass." And then Dad would shout back, "Louder, louder," until either he or we became frustrated. On this Christmas Eve, I approached my place in front of the altar with sweaty palms and began, "And it came to pass." I glanced out into the congregation to spot my dad. Suddenly, his usual stony expression transformed into a series of crazy faces designed to make me smile. It worked. On the drive home from the service, I felt disappointment rather than the usual excitement. Tonight was the night we opened the wrapped presents from our relatives. Our foray under our parents' bed caused, for the first time, neither of us to protest the grown-ups' annual teasing that we would drive around and look at Christmas lights before returning home for gifts. Despite our snooping, we still had some fun opening or reopening gifts, feigning surprise, and watching Daddy unwrap his box of chocolate-covered cherries to discover there were only two or three left in the box. He had done a little pre-Christmas snooping of his own. The box remained perfectly wrapped under the tree for a week, but he had cut a hole in the bottom and had been pilfering the bonbons one by one. The chocolate-covered cherry doesn't fall far from the tree. After the wrapping paper explosion was cleaned up, we set out the Santa treats, hugged our parents and grandparents, and settled into the divan, ready to put our plan for discovery into motion. Sister and I talked and giggled and pledged to wake the other if one should fall asleep before we spied the old man in red. I lay on my back and stared at the pie-shaped hole in the transom, practicing my one-eye-open exercise. Before I knew what had happened, I awoke to a sun ray peeking through the lace curtains, and Sister was still fast asleep. I sat up and looked around the living room. It was daylight. The tree was lit and surrounded by gifts, Betsy Wetsy, the freaky baby doll, puzzles and games. The plate held partially eaten cookies and the glass of milk was half empty. The old room was filled with magic. Santa was a spirit, for I had not seen or heard a thing. Even after all of our investigation and strategy planning, Santa had slipped through our grasps again. But for this year and all the years to follow, he had taught me a lesson I would always remember. Some things in life should not be tampered with. Not everything needs to be investigated or explained. In fact, the very best things are those we can leave untouched to enjoy as forever wonderful mysteries.
Sandra Spots Hamilton grew up watching for Santa in Little Rock, where she still lives and works as a designer and freelance writer. The older she gets, the more she believes in magic. In our final story of the night, Bill Scott takes us back to one of his childhood Christmases that stayed with him in more ways than one in Redneck Christmas Miracle.
Every year, I'd circle hundreds of items in the Sears and JCPenney catalogs. Circle first, then go through a second time, add a check to the things I really needed, and on the third time through, star the items that were essential for life. Easy peasy for your shopping convenience. But my needs went unfulfilled. It was as if my parents didn't understand the meaning of Christmas. December 1977, top of the list, pocket knife. Testosterone had finally kicked in. It was gonna be a very, very butch Christmas special. A knife and an 8-year-old boy, what could possibly go wrong? No, Mom said, in a sporadic moment of parental clarity. It's not happening. No knives. Some version of the following conversation played out through the month of December. Mom, he's going to cut himself. Me, no, I'm not. Dad, Loretta, quit babying him. I could tell by the way Dad looked at me, brow furrowed and head cocked. He, too, thought it was a bad idea. But honestly, I think he was just thrilled it wasn't an easy bake oven like last year. Christmas 1976, I asked for an easy bake oven. Perfect, right? Cakes. Who doesn't want cake on demand? Sorry, while you schmucks spend your time choking down mother's cabbage rolls at the dinner table, I'll be in my room having a freshly baked cake. Freedom. It smelled like cream cheese frosting. My mom, the answer, easy bake oven? No, that's a girl's toy. Toy? It wasn't a toy, it was a means to an end. Are you really going to refuse me piping hot chocolate cake in the privacy of my room to satisfy your own heterosexual agenda? Hateful, wicked, cake-depriving woman? Apparently, yes, she was. She was determined to mold me into the man she wanted me to be. That man was not a pastry chef, a gymnast, or a tap dancer. No, no, no. So I didn't get the oven, but it was a mixed message Christmas miracle. Without even having asked for him, I got Stretch Armstrong. Stretch in all his muscly glory and blue Speedo was crazy hot. So I took the perfectly smooth, tan-skinned doll and begged my sister to use her oven. I had my eye on the devil's food cake. How exotic, food from the devil. One of Satan's tasty little treats right there in my sister's closet. She, of course, power hungry and cake stingy, declined. She said it was too much trouble to get the oven out of the box. Lazy, just plain lazy. But the chocolate devil tempted me. And I devised a plan to sneak into her room, take the oven back to mine, and bake the cake. I'd definitely have to sneak, as I'd been banned from going into her room when she wasn't in it. The week before, I'd cut Barbie's hair. Dorothy Hamill wedge, the latest style. Under her bed, hidden away all Anne Frank-like, was a box overflowing with Barbies, and the wedge was not as easy of a cut as you might imagine, especially given Barbie's overprocessed hair. But by the time I'd gotten to the last Barbie, I was pretty good at it. Do you think my sister was grateful? No, she was not. Sensing I was up to no good, she lingered in her room, and I was unable to get to the oven. Perhaps I'd stare too longingly at the closet doors that hid the easy bake. Satan's delicious treatsies and Christmas, a combination that wasn't meant to be. Surely, after the previous year's girl-centric toy obsession, Christmas 1977 would be different. There was a good chance I would get the macho, tough guy present I'd asked for. You would have thought my parents would be fumbling over themselves to buy me a pocket knife. A knife, a hand grenade, a hooker. anything that screamed, "Yes, my son is a heterosexual. Thank you for noticing." "Why do you want a pocket knife?" Mom asked. "Why?" Why was hard to explain other than to whittle. That's what Jed did, and he was a millionaire living in Beverly Hills. And that's what I wanted, to sit in front of my mansion, whittling with Jethro and Granny. I planned to carve a wooden flute. Ugh, Mommy's face soured. Flutes apparently were not macho. Fortunately, I saved her from having an outright stroke. I didn't tell her the master plan was to eventually carve a French horn, perhaps the gayest instrument of all time. December 24th came. The presents were neatly packed beneath the tree. I rifled through them. None were small enough to be a pocket knife. The stores closed early on Christmas Eve. There was precious little time for Mom and Dad to fulfill their parental obligations. "Walmart is open till 5, maybe 6. You better leave now just to be safe. I'm sure they have pocket knives." "Bill, I told you, you're too young. Maybe next year." "How old do you have to be to actually start getting the stuff you want?" "You get more than you need. Don't be greedy." Here's the thing. It's not greed if you really want it. And I wanted it. But she didn't understand 8-year-old boy logic. Christmas Eve sleep was always fitful, but especially so when you know you're doomed to stay unarmed for eternity. But that morning, in my stocking was a crudely wrapped package, twisted red paper and enough tape to restrain a small dog. It had been dad-wrapped. The size, the weight, the shape, all were perfect for a pocket knife. It was a Christmas conundrum. The pocket knife was in my hand, but it would take a pocket knife to get through the Fort Knox wrapping. Like a wolf trying to free its leg from a trap, I gnawed at the tape until it gave way. "Pocket knife, thank you, baby Jesus." With my weak, girly arms, I was unable to spring the blade from its handle, a defeat I hadn't seen coming. When Dad finally opened it for me, it smelled of WD-40 and danger. Closing it was easier, and I assumed since I was unable to reopen it, Mom and Dad figured there'd be no blood spilled Christmas morning. However, once in the safety of my room, using my teeth and every bit of strength in my neck, I freed the blade from its prison. I had a block of wood from the Cub Scout Pinewood Derby still in its original uncarved rectangular shape. That was about to change. It was time to commence a whittling. The blade felt cold as it sliced through my flesh. Not at all what I would have thought. Less than a minute after opening the knife, I got to see what the tendons in my thumb looked like. White with a bit of clear fluid. The key to whittling is to whittle away from the hand holding the wood, not towards. Who knew a lesson awaited on Christmas morn? It was the longest, deepest cut anyone, anywhere, had ever had. Yet there was surprisingly little blood. I assumed it was because my heart stopped the minute I cut myself. "Mom, he's gonna cut himself." "Me? No, I'm not." I couldn't risk putting a Band-Aid on my thumb and letting Mom know she'd been right. That would be a bad precedent to set. If I kept my thumb hyperextended, the edges of the cut stayed approximated, and there was no bleeding. So I spent Christmas Day pretending I was Arthur Fonzarelli. Hey! They never found out, and I never whittled a flute. That's not a euphemism. Get your mind out of the gutter.
Bill Scott spent his youth being awkward and making his parents uncomfortable. His stories pair best with Kentucky bourbon or a hoppy IPA. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
All right, we're going to do another original.
I picked up the phone this morning. It's time to leave.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.